Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Ida History. I'm your host, Jeff Wade, sitting here with my beautiful co-host, Mark Iverson. What's going on there, Mark?
Why, thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome.
You know, I'm just sitting here thinking about last week's episode and, you know, how I'm not very surprised that, you know, it was a popular episode.
Yes.
But also, I'm not surprised that, you know, we got some, and I'm just going to call them what I think they are, wackadoodles. We got some people who are just like, I heard about some tunnels and I was in what I thought was a tunnel, you know, and they were in spaces. I totally believe that. And then some people were like, there are tunnels underneath the Capitol. I'm like, yeah, we're not saying there aren't passageways or tunnels. We're just saying they weren't built by the Chinese, and there's no evidence to show that they were built by the Chinese. You know, and all the historians and archivists and architects and everybody we were, you know, using as evidence. But anyway, it was interesting, and those are my notable, you know, divergences from reality that came out of the, you know, loony bin for us.
What I hate, Mark, is when people comment on our posts when they didn't even listen to the episode, and it's very apparent that they didn't listen to the episode from their comments, and they're still trying to tell us that we're wrong, even though they didn't even listen to any of the evidence that we presented. So it's like, why even waste our time trying to talk to these people? But we do, and it always ends up a certain way, right?
I think for me, it's like a personal twinge. You know, like I should just – the better thing, I think – would be to just be like, whatever, block them, get rid of them, whatever, just ignore them. But I just, at first I have to think about how to reply to this, like, ridiculousness. And then I have to, it's just like a personal bone for me, but you know, it's a lot better than it used to be. And then, you know, I like conversing with people that are just like, well, I've heard this, and then just give them our evidence. You know,
yeah. And there was a couple of commenters that were like, oh, okay, I didn't know that, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And now moving on, you know, it's like there are other things than Chinese tunnels, like Chinese history away from tunnels, which I know we'll get to again.
Well, we got a couple of announcements we need to make. Our first book together, Murder, Mayhem, and Boise, was cataloged by the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley. So that's pretty big news, Mark. The Bancroft Library is the biggest collection of Western history in the United States. So that's pretty cool. It means our work will live forever there.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And, you know, this is not quite as amazing, but I finally saw two copies of Murder and Mayhem in the Eagle Library today. So I was happy, and my kids were like, oh, that's your book, Daddy. I'm like, and Jeff's too.
Very nice. And speaking of books, Mark, the next book, Haunted Boise, is coming out September 25th. Mark, why don't you tell people where they can pre-order that?
They can pre-order Haunted Boise by Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson at Pearl House Collective, their online shop, right? And I think they have a connection through Pearl House Collective and Instagram. I don't think they have much of a Facebook profile, but I might be wrong. And then you can go to their website, pearlhousecollective.com, I believe.
You could pre-order it from Amazon or Barnes and Nobles, but Pearl House Collective is a local online bookseller trying to build a brick and mortar store. So we definitely like to support Chelsea and Pearl House whenever we can, right?
Yeah, you know, Pearl House is the way to go if you want to support local bookshops. You know, also Flying M downtown in Boise, 5th in Idaho, and also Rediscovered Books in Boise. We always prefer you to get it from, you know, local booksellers when you can.
Of course. All right, Mark, with that, I think we should get into this episode. Why don't we tell the people what we're talking about tonight?
Well, you know, one of my favorite songs by Queen with a little Bowie thrown in is Under Pressure. too soon. Sorry. But, you know, since it's been in the news, you know, so much this summer with the implosion of the Titan submersible, we're going to tell the story of the six people who boarded the RMS Titanic in April of 1912, or en route to Idaho.
Pretty interesting stories that we'll talk about tonight. But first, some sources. I actually remembered this time to put my sources on here, Mark. Hope you're proud of me for that.
I am.
So we've got, of course, various newspapers, including the Idaho Statesman and the Payette Enterprise, which was a new one for me. I've never used that newspaper before. And then immigration records from Ancestry.com were pretty important as well. And I relied heavily on the Titanic Encyclopedia, which is an online website. It's pretty cool. And the cool thing I like about that is that they actually list all their primary sources at the bottom of the page of each article.
Oh, I love that.
So I was also able to get some more info from the two living relatives of two of the Titanic passengers that we're going to talk about tonight. And we'll mention that as we go here. And I also spent a lot of time looking for a house in Payette via census maps, but I failed there, unfortunately. You might have to help me with that one, Mark. And finally, I need to thank the Titanic subreddit, where I have been wasting a lot of time lately. And that's where I first got the idea that there might be some connections between Idaho and the Titanic disaster. So thanks for everyone that contributes to the Titanic subreddit. It's a great place to hang out. So, Mark, we're going to start tonight by talking about a man named Antti Wilhelm Savola. Hoping I'm pronouncing that right. He was a Finlander, so I'm not great of Finnish. Savola was planning to travel to Mountain Home, Idaho. And for anyone not familiar with that, that's about 40 miles east of Boise, and it happens to be where I grew up. Back in 1912, the big industries in town were sheep and cattle. There was a rail station on the Oregon Short Line, which allowed ranchers access to the livestock markets. And this was the type of work that Antti Savola was probably going to be engaged in.
Savola was born in, oh boy, Ruotsinpäihata. Jeez, that's a easy one right there. You got even like some umlauts in there. But this was in southern Finland. Sadly, not much is known about his life. He was around 21 years old when he was obtained, or when he obtained his passport on March 30th, 1912. On April 3rd, 1912, he departed Hanko, Finland, on the Polaris, a steamship operated by the Finnish Steamship Company. And that would have left him, along with other Finnish passengers, in Hull, England. There he paid 553 Finnish marks, or about £7, and that's $35 at the time, or around $1,071 today, for a ticket to board the Titanic from Southampton, England, to New York City.
Well, that was a third-class ticket, Mark.
So he wasn't with Kate Winslet's crew up there on the top.
Definitely not. He was more of a Jack.
I wonder if he was a budding artist.
I don't know. Maybe. Mm-hmm. So he joined 63 other Finns ready to make their new life in America, four of which were in second class and the remainder were in third, or steerage. We tend to focus on the rich people aboard the Titanic, like Rose and company, but the majority were second and third class passengers who were headed to America to find work and start fresh. Savola, like we mentioned, was headed to Mountain Home, where he had a job waiting for him with Andrew and Elizabeth Honga.
The Hongas were also from Finland, and Andrew had traveled to Idaho with his brother-in-law, Adolf Latinen, in the late 1890s or 1901, depending on the source. Honga and Latinen settled in Mountain Home and established a sheep herd in the Owyhee Mountains. Once they were making money, they sent for their wives.
Elizabeth Honga was an interesting lady. She took up residence in the old Turner home, which would have been one of the first homes built in Mountain Home. There, she practiced midwifery and cured rheumatism, nervousness in all of its phases, as well as stomach and liver problems. She also gave massage treatments. So basically, she was a real-life Dr. Quinn medicine woman.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Quinn. Okay. Yeah. So, ready for a new job and a new life in Idaho, Antti Savola boarded the RMS Titanic on April 10th, 1912. The ship was at the time the largest man-made moving object in the world. The ship, along with her sisters, Olympic and Britannic, was built and operated by the White Star Line, a company that operated 29 ships in 1912. The line transported passengers and goods across the Atlantic Ocean.
After departing from Southampton, the Titanic sailed over to Cherbourg, France, and then to Queenstown, Ireland, and loaded up some additional passengers before setting off for New York, where she was supposed to arrive on April 17th. The Titanic was designed to hold 2,435 passengers and about 900 crew members. Now, on this maiden voyage, she wasn't quite full. Savola was one of 2,240 passengers aboard, along with 908 crew members.
Wow, that's a lot of people. On April 14th, the Titanic started receiving warnings of icebergs in their path. At 5:50 p.m., Captain Edward J. Smith orders a course change, which was to take the ship on a more southerly route to avoid the ice. At 9:40, Titanic's wireless operator received another warning, but by then he had made contact with the telegraph station at Cape Race, Newfoundland, and he was sending messages for passengers, which was the primary purpose for the wireless radios at the time. The coming disaster would help change that, though.
The ice warning either wasn't passed onto the bridge or was ignored. 20 minutes later, at 10 p.m., shift change occurred on the deck, with First Officer Murdoch, William Murdoch, taking command. Also at this time, lookouts Frederick Fleet and Reginald Lee began their watch in the crow's nest. The lookouts had a couple of things working against them. First, it was a very calm night, meaning there were no waves to break against the icebergs, making them more difficult to spot. They also had no binoculars because the officer that had possession of the key to the cabinet that the binoculars were kept in had been transferred off the ship at the last moment, and he took the key with him.
Also working against them was the distraction caused when Jack and Rose burst onto the deck after making whoopee in the car in the cargo hold. Oh, wait, no, that was the movie.
Right. We'll reference the 1997 James Cameron movie a couple times just because that's what most people are familiar with when we're talking about the Titanic, right?
I just wanted to throw in there when it first came out, my friend Chris Lord and I went on a date with some fine ladies. And while they were in Titanic, we snuck out, you know, to go to the bathroom. And then we went in to watch Firestorm with the football player turned action star Howie Long.
Wow.
It was quite the movie. Let me tell you how he took care of some evil doers while also fighting a forest fire.
Interesting. I've never heard of that movie.
Yeah, that's because Titanic came out then. I think otherwise it would have been a classic.
Probably.
Right. You know, hey, but anyway, yeah.
So at 10:55 p.m., the SS California, which was about 15 miles from the Titanic, sent a message warning that she was stopped because of thick ice. At 11:35, the Californian turned off its radio and the operator went to bed. At about the same time, Frederick Fleet, up in the crow's nest, first spotted the deadly iceberg right ahead of the ship. He called the bridge and told First Officer Murdoch of the danger.
Murdoch ordered the ship to steer hard to starboard, and the engines reversed, but there just wasn't enough warning, and the side of the ship scraped the iceberg. Now the Titanic had 15 watertight compartments that could be sealed off in the event the hull was compromised. The idea basically was to slow or stop the flow of water into the rest of the ship. Four of these compartments could be filled with water, and the ship would still float. Unfortunately, five or six were flooded.
Immediately, the ship's carpenter and Thomas Andrews, who was the chief designer of the Titanic, who happened to be aboard for her maiden voyage, started to assess the damage. It was determined that the ship would sink in about 2 to 3 hours. At midnight, the order was given to start loading the lifeboats. The Titanic carried 20 lifeboats, which could hold just under 1,200 people. And tragically, many of those lifeboats were not completely loaded when they were launched, and two of the lifeboats were not able to launch at all in time.
At 12:40, the RMS Carpathia receives the distress call from the Titanic. The Carpathia set a course, but even at full speed, it would take 3.5 hours to reach the sinking ship. By 2 a.m., the front of the bow of the Titanic had sunk so low that the propellers in the stern or rear of the ship were visible rising up out of the water. At 2:17, the final distress call is sent out, and a minute later, the ship's lights go out, plunging the ship into darkness. The bow continued to sink, and the strain broke the ship in half.
When the bow broke free from the stern, it traveled an estimated 30 miles per hour before crashing into the seafloor. The stern settles back into the water before what is now the front of that section floods and gets pulled down into the water, sending the back up into the sky before the stern also sinks at 2:20 a.m. The Carpathia arrives at 3:30 a.m. and is able to rescue 705 survivors from the Titanic's lifeboats. 1,517 people died in the sinking.
Sadly, Auntie Sihova was not among those taken aboard the Carpathia, and he was not among the 337 identified bodies later pulled from the North Atlantic. An item in the Elmore County Republican on May 4, 1912 states, "The Republican has just received information to the effect that among the list of passengers aboard the ill-fated Titanic was one, Andrew, oh, that's easier, Sihova, a young man of Finland who was en route to Mountain Home, where he was to have received employment with Mr. A. Honga, an old friend of Mr. Sihova's father. Of the 537 Finlanders aboard, 13 were saved." Wow.
There weren't 537 Finlanders aboard. I'm not sure where the Republican got that number. Like I said earlier, there were 63 Finlanders aboard. So I'm not sure where they got 537. That would have been like a third of the passengers.
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Must have been a mistake in the reporting. Anyway. Mark, now researching this story, you hear a lot about some of the first class passengers who died, such as John Jacob Astor IV, who was the richest man in the world at the time. But when I focus on these stories that we're talking about, I realize that it was mostly immigrants aboard the Titanic. And it reminded me of the story of my great-grandmother, Randy Holmquist, who was born in Norway. Her father was from Sweden, though. In 1910, they decided to come to America, which they did aboard the RMS Canada, which was also a White Star Line / Dominion Line ship. They ended up settling in a Mormon community near Idaho Falls called Ozone. And I imagine thousands of early Idahoans came from Europe on these ships. So, Mark, tell us about the next set of immigrants who had their sights set on the Jim State.
We don't have too many details about Mr. and Mrs. Howard. Ellen Truelove was born in Wiltshire, England in 1851. She married Benjamin Howard in 1872. He was born in Lancashire in 1848, and he made a living as a bolt maker, eventually retiring as foreman of a bolt factory in Swindon, England.
Ellen and Benjamin had four children who survived infancy, boys William, Frederick, and Herbert, and then one girl named Ethel. Frederick and Herbert had moved to America, settling in Buell, Idaho. I couldn't find much on Frederick, but Herbert Ben Howard came to the U.S. in 1908 at the age of 24. His occupation, listed on the immigration form, was pattern maker, but he took up farming in Buell.
Benjamin's health was poor, so he and Ellen decided to take the journey across the pond to visit their sons in Buell. Now, the town of Buell was only 6 years old at the time, having been founded in 1906 and named after Frank Buell, an investor from Pennsylvania, who helped get the major irrigation project in the area started. Buell was also featured on Season 6, Episode 2 of The X-Files, where Scully and Mulder investigate a beet farmer who ordered a bunch of fertilizers, you know, making sure he wasn't a bomb maker. You know, Bryan Cranston guest starred in that episode.
That's one of the most interesting things I could find about Buell, so there you go.
Oh, you're kidding me. Buell.
I'm kidding.
It's where people go to party. That's what I heard.
Oh, yeah?
No, that might have been some other town. Yeah, yeah.
Sadly, Ellen and Benjamin were also among those killed in the sinking, and their bodies were not recovered. Their estate was awarded to their oldest son, William, back in England. Herbert, though, he would go on to join the Army during World War I and serve in the brand new Aero Corps as a sergeant. He returned to Idaho and eventually moved to Caldwell. He had a home on Arthur Street. Actually, Mark, that's just about a block over from the house that my great-grandfather Charles Wade passed away in.
Look at that
picture I sent you. His house was, Herbert's house was where the yellow circle is, and my grandfather's great-grandfather's house is where the green circle is.
You know, if you would have said he was, old Herbert was on the Lusitania, I would have been like, oh, man. Well, many of Ellen and Benjamin's descendants still live in Idaho, though. On April 15th, 2012, an article in the Lewiston Tribune interviewed Mary Pell, Megan Ahi, or Ahai?
I think Ahai.
Ahai. And Richard Smith, who are all great-grandchildren of the Howards. The article talks about a postcard and a letter sent from Cherbourg and Queenstown from Ellen, talking about how she was bringing to Idaho a pair of hair clippers at the request of Herbert. It is possible that he wanted to use them to start a barbering business, but of course they ended up at the bottom of the Atlantic. However, the three Howard descendants in the article all happen to be hairstylists, so Howard's legacy lives on here in Idaho. Thank you to Tracy and Janine Smith, who helped us out with some of the additional information on the Howards.
Yeah, I was actually able to contact them through Ancestry, and they gave me a bit of information, so that was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool, indeed. It was easier to be a historian than it was a long time ago, I do think.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. I wouldn't know what to do if I didn't have Ancestries and Newspapers.com.
Snail mail, I guess.
Yeah. I think about old Dick DeEsom, who literally had to comb through the Statesman's archives just to find his stories.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's quite the writer, though.
Yes. All right, Mark. So that brings us to the Collier family of Surrey County, England. And I'm sorry, this is got to be probably one of the saddest stories I've ever heard. So get your Kleenex ready.
I'm there, Jeff.
Right. So Charlotte Tate married Harvey Collier after growing up near each other and attending the same church. Charlotte left home at an early age and became the domestic cook for the church's reverend. And Harvey was the sextant and verger, which is a new word that I learned. It basically is a caretaker. The couple had one child, a daughter named Marjorie Lottie.
When the church's reverend moved to Bishopstoke, Hampshire, the Colliers followed. Charlotte continued to work for the reverend while Harvey ran a grocery store and was on the church council, as was the bell ringer. A good friend of Harvey and Charlotte, John P. Hallett and his wife, had left England and went to America, where they found success working at a fruit farm in Payette, Idaho. Payette is about 50 miles west of Boise, right on the Idaho-Oregon border. Originally, an OSL construction camp called Boomerang. Oh, I like that one. The town was later renamed for Francis Payette, or Francois Payette, an early trapper and trader in the area. The Hallets sent letters to the Colliers asking them to join them in Idaho.
And OSL, I just want to make sure everyone knows what that means. That's the Oregon Short Line Railroad, which is the major railroad line that runs from Wyoming to Oregon through southern Idaho.
It's a good one.
Oh, classic. Boy. Classic, yeah, railroad. Yeah.
Classic, really. The best.
The Colliers, of course, they were hesitant to pick up and move to the States, but then Charlotte began having increasingly bad respiratory symptoms caused by tuberculosis. Mark, you talked about this in the Dr. Hart Trans Healer of Idaho Consumptives episode, that basically it was thought that when the TB patient moved to a drier climate, it would help with the symptoms of the disease. And this convinced Harvey that they should pick up and move to Idaho and buy their own fruit farm.
You know, right. And shoot, even in a drier climate, a lot of people were taken by TB. So, you know, I don't know. That would be an interesting comparison between like moist climates and people with TB and, you know, the drier climates. Charlotte later wrote of their farewell from the church. Hundreds of people showed up to say goodbye to the family, during which they made Harvey sit under a tree in the churchyard and then rang the church bells and chimes for an hour in his honor. The next morning, the family was in Southampton, preparing for the journey. Harvey withdrew all of the family savings from the bank in cash, which included the money from the sale of the store in Bishopstoke. In total, it was several thousand dollars. He safely stored the cash in his jacket pocket for the trip. The Colliers then loaded everything they owned onto the Titanic and settled in their second-class cabin for the trip.
Charlotte later recalled that she was quite afraid of the ocean, but was reassured that the new ship was not only unsinkable, but the officers would be extra careful during her maiden voyage. Charlotte mentions that their cabin was pretty far forward on the ship and that they were able to watch the great send-off of the crowd that had gathered at the Southampton docks. Again, if you've seen the 1997 James Cameron Titanic movie, that's the opening scene where old Leo is running through the crowd trying to get on board. But Charlotte also witnessed the near miss when another ocean liner, the SS New York, was which was moored nearby, drifted from its moorings and almost hit the Titanic as it started its journey. A quick-acting tug captain was able to pull the New York away just before the collision occurred.
Well, that's kind of ironic, being they were headed to New York, I guess. But, hey, right, yeah. You know, coinkydink, I guess. But for the first several days the Titanic was underway, Charlotte felt seasick, so she stayed in the family's cabin. On Sunday, the 14th of April, she felt better, so she went to have dinner in the second-class dining saloon. She was impressed that there seemed to be no expense spared in feeding the second-class passengers. After dinner, she listened to the orchestra before returning to her cabin. Around 9 p.m., a stewardess came in, and while doing her duty, struck up a conversation. She told Charlotte that they were in the area of the North Atlantic where icebergs had been known to drift. She also mentioned that the temperature on deck had dropped.
This conversation actually put Charlotte at ease, as it indicated the crew was well aware of any danger. She drifted off to sleep for a while until Harvey came into the cabin, and they started talking while he prepared for bed.
Charlotte recounts that when the ship struck the iceberg, it felt as if Titanic had been grabbed by a giant hand and shaken twice, then came to a dead halt. She was not thrown from her bed, and Harvey was able to remain on his feet, staggering only slightly. They didn't hear the scrape of the iceberg, but they could tell the engines were shut down soon after the ship hit. Harvey decided to get dressed and head up to the deck to see what happened while Charlotte stayed in bed with Marjorie.
Harvey returned a few minutes later with the news that the ship had struck an iceberg. Charlotte asked if people on deck seemed worried, but Harvey reassured her. They thought about going back to bed for a moment, but then the sound of people running by their cabin door frightened both of them. They decided to go back up to the deck and see what was going on.
Charlotte hurriedly dressed in a gown and overcoat and tied up her loose hair with a ribbon. She remarked that the ship was tipping forward a bit at this point. This was happening because those watertight compartments were filling with water, bringing the bow of the ship down. Once she was ready, Charlotte picked up Marjorie and wrapped her up in a cabin blanket. Marjorie forgot to grab the doll she had brought with her from England.
Up on deck, everyone was fairly calm. The officers were there, reassuring passengers that there was no danger. Suddenly, a commotion was heard nearby, and one of the stokers, which are the guys that would shovel the coal into the coal engines. Anyway, one of these guys climbed up from the below. He stopped a few feet away from the colliers, and Charlotte could see that the fingers of one of his hands was cut off, and there was blood spurting out of the stumps. Charlotte asked the stoker if there was any danger. The man told her that the ship would sink like a log in 10 minutes. As the man staggered away, panic set in on the deck. Among it all, Marjorie remembered her doll and began crying for someone to go back and get it.
Of course, her parents weren't willing to do that. The family stood together for the next few minutes together watching the chaos unfold. First, Officer Murdoch ordered gangways to be guarded so no more injured crew could come up to the top. Other officers ran to and fro shouting orders, and passengers begged for answers to questions. At midnight, the order to prepare the lifeboats was given just 20 minutes after the ship struck the iceberg. Man, that's kind of cold to just shut off so the crewmen would have to, like, be down there trapped.
Yeah. I mean, you got to make these decisions Damn. When thousands of lives are at stake, right?
I guess, but geez.
When the order was given to load the boats, it was followed by a cry of women and children first. Not wanting to be separated from her husband, Charlotte watched two lifeboats get loaded and launched. When the third was half full, a sailor tore Marjorie away from Charlotte and put her in the boat. Charlotte didn't know what to do, go with her child or stay with her husband. Marjorie's only concern at this point was for her doll.
The choice was made for Charlotte when another man told her to get in the boat before it was too late. By this time, the bow of the ship was flooded and the deck was at a sharp angle. It took two men to drag Charlotte away from Harvey and place her in the boat. Harvey's last words to her were, "Go, Lottie, for God's sake, be brave, and go. I'll get a seat in another boat." She watched Harvey walk into the crowd and never saw him again.
The lifeboat that Charlotte and Marjorie found themselves in was number 14. For those of you who are familiar with the James Cameron 1997 film, the officer who was loading the boat, a guy named 5th Officer Harold Lowe, he felt the crowd was getting too unruly, so he fired a couple of shots from his pistol to keep control of the situation. Now, this happened a little differently in real life. As the boat was being lowered, it was passing a lower deck, and Officer Lowe thought that several men from that deck were going to try to jump into the boat. That's why he fired several shots from his personal Browning automatic pistol over the ocean to try to keep them back.
Charlotte also tells of a young boy who was standing near the boat as it was being loaded, waiting to be told to get on. When the boat started to be lowered, the kid, described as a schoolboy, panicked and jumped into the boat. He crawled under a seat, and Charlotte and another one covered him with their skirts. Officer Lowe grabbed the boy and ordered him back on the ship at gunpoint, but Marjorie grabbed the officer's hand and asked him not to shoot the kid. The officer relented, changing his tone. He told the kid to be a man, and that they had to stop at lower decks to pick up more women and children. The kid then crawled back onto the Titanic to await his fate. Marjorie later reported that she didn't remember intervening. Yeah, but wasn't he a schoolboy? Shouldn't they have kept him on there? You know, that's the question that comes to my head, you know?
Oh, man, this is one of those kind of rabbit holes you can go down and kind of identify other people who were talked about in other people's stories, you know? I didn't figure out who he was. I know he didn't survive. I don't know if he was a third-class passenger or not. He probably was, though.
I read an article quite some time ago, but it talked about how some of the what you saw on the Titanic was a clear glimpse at you know, kind of the class structure that was broken apart by World War One, you know, and, you know, nobility and monarchy and the high, rich, wealthy, you know, but you could see that displayed on the behavior towards the different classes of passengers.
Well, and it's interesting if you think about it, a lot of the people who died on the Titanic, they, especially the crewmen who were young, able-bodied men, if they hadn't died on the Titanic, they probably would have fought in France in World War One. So, you know, die on the Titanic or die during World War One. So,
right. I'd take Titanic, I guess. But
I don't know. Regardless. I'd take the war. I think I'd have a better shot of surviving that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You still have a shot, is your point. Okay. Yeah. I'd take the war.
Yeah. Although, you know, drowning is said to be pretty peaceful, or dying of hypothermia, I guess, is how most of the people on Titanic drowned or died.
At least if they had a life jacket.
All right. So the boat was lowered, and Charlotte was able to get a glimpse of the iceberg that sunk the ship. She said, quote, "It loomed up in the clear starlight, a bluish-white mountain quite near to us. There were two other icebergs nearby and several other pieces of ice. As the boat was being rowed away, she looked back at the ship, which was supposed to take her to a new life." And this is what she said about it. Quote, "I shall never forget the terrible beauty of the Titanic at that moment. She was tilted forward, head down, with her first funnel partly underwater. To me, she looked like an enormous glowworm, for she was a light above the rising waterline, clear to her stern. Electric lights blazing in every cabin, lights on all the decks, and lights at her mastheads. And no sound reached us except the music of the band, which I seemed, strange to say, to be aware of for the first time. Oh, those brave musicians, how wonderful they were. They were playing lively tunes, ragtime, and they kept it up to the very end. Only the engulfing ocean had power to drown them into silence."
Charlotte next describes the moment the ship broke apart and sank. "The Titanic broke in two before my eyes. The fore part was already partly underwater. It wallowed over and disappeared instantly. The stern reared straight on end and stood poised on the ocean for many seconds. They seemed minutes to me. It was only then that the electric lights on board went out. Before the darkness came, I saw hundreds of human bodies clinging to the wreck or leaping into the water. I turned my face away, but looked round the next instant and saw the second half of the great boat slip below the surface as easily as a pebble in a pond." Her description of how the boat sank was important because for many years it was ignored. It was not until Dr. Ballard discovered the wreck in 1985, and it was confirmed that Titanic broke into two before sinking below the waves. Many other survivors also described this, but they were ignored because they were women and children. Of course, Marjorie also mentions the sinking in her account, but her biggest worry was that no one would keep her doll from getting wet.
While the Titanic was settling on the ocean floor, Lifeboat 14 was finding other lifeboats. Officer Lowe ordered that they be lashed together to prevent them from drifting apart. Then he transferred several of the women and children from his boat to the others and then went back to look for survivors. So again, if you know the 1997 movie, this is the part where the boat is going through the debris and bodies. And remember, there's one line where the officer says not to hit the dead people with the paddle as they're rowing through. Kind of a poignant line.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
So then they come across a young woman floating on a door who had just let her lover sink to the bottom of the Atlantic. That's what happened in the movie, right? What really happened is they found a man named Fang Lang floating on a door. He was one of 8 Chinese sailors on board the ship and one of 6 who survived. He became the inspiration for how Rose survived in the movie. There's a documentary called The 6 about these Chinese survivors. Unfortunately, it's not available for streaming in the U.S. And so I've been wanting to watch it, but it's not available. Kind of frustrating. But sadly, these 6 Chinese men weren't allowed to enter the U.S. because of the exclusion law. So when they got to New York, they were deported down to Cuba.
Jeez, you think they'd cut them a break, you know?
Right.
I think if those... those 6 guys were depicted in the movie, it might have had a different feeling at the end. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, in the movie, though, I was just like, couldn't you try to let Jack up on the door? You know, just maybe give it a go. But I guess it would have started to sink if they did that. So they didn't want to risk it. I don't know. But yeah, for the next 3 hours,
there wouldn't have been enough buoyancy to keep it afloat. And there's a documentary that James Cameron did for National Geographic where they actually tested this and they put 2 actors that were the same size and build as Leo and Kate and made them in freezing water get on top of this piece of wood. And that's exactly what happened. The piece of wood sank out from underneath them, basically. The only way they could have both survived is basically if they locked up their elbows and kept their cores above the surface of the water to keep their cores out of the freezing cold water. And that's the only way both of them could have survived.
Oh, did people survive in the water by doing that?
There was only a couple people. I think they say like 15 people that had gone into the water that came back out alive. Fang Lang, the Chinese man, was one of them. The other one was the chief baker for the Titanic. When Jack and Rose go up to the back of the boat, the stern, right before it sinks down to the water, he's up on top of it and he's drinking from a flask. And in real life, he had reported that he had been drinking liquor, and that's what supposedly saved him from hypothermia once he did go into the water.
I'm going to tell that to everybody who accuses me of drinking too much, you know?
Yes.
But for the next 3 hours, the 705 survivors floated around the ocean. Finally, at 3:30 a.m., the RMS Carpathia arrived and began unloading Titanic's lifeboats. Carpathia made it to New York on April 18th, the day after the Titanic was supposed to, and the thousands of people gathered at the docks to watch the Titanic survivors unload. Mrs. Hallett, who was waiting for the Colliers in Payette, sent a telegraph to her brother in New York asking him to take care of Charlotte and Marjorie. The brother couldn't make it, but he sent Mr. Fred Waterman and Mr. William Smith to help them. When the Carpathia arrived, Mr. Waterman was standing there with a cardboard sign with their name written on it, but he had to board the ship to find Charlotte and Marjorie. It was at the dock in New York where Charlotte faced the harsh reality that her husband had died in the sinking and that Harvey went down with all the family's money in his pocket. Oh, no. No. Oh, no, he didn't. Wow, that's harsh.
Yeah.
Damn.
I mean, I think, you know, he told Charlotte that he was going to go to another boat, and I think he intended to do that. But it just didn't happen, unfortunately.
Yeah. He just probably thought, like, oh, they have enough for everybody.
Right. So Charlotte and Marjorie were taken to Mr. Waterman's home at 297 Marlborough Road in Brooklyn. And there's a pretty famous photograph of them taken at the home, sitting on the porch swing. Now, Charlotte looks dazed, staring off into the distance, her hair a mess. Marjorie looks hauntingly straight into the camera. On Charlotte's lap, there is a plaid blanket with the White Star Line logo on it. This was the blanket she was given in the lifeboat to keep her warm, and I believe the blanket on Marjorie's lap was the one that her mother wrapped her in before leaving the cabin on the Titanic.
From the Waterman home in Brooklyn, she wrote a letter to her mother, in part saying, "Some want me to go back to England, but I can't. I could never, at least not yet, go over the ground where my all is sleeping. Sometimes I feel we live too much for each other. That is why I've lost him. But mother, we shall meet him in heaven. When that band played Near My God to Thee, I know he thought of you and me, for we both love that hymn, and I feel that if I go to Payette, I'm doing what he would wish me to. So I hope to do this at the end of next week, where I shall have friends and work, and I will work for his darling as long as she needs me."
After receiving some clothing and money from the good people of New York and from a fund that was being put together for the survivors at the White Star Line office, Charlotte decided it was time to go on to Payette. They arrived there on Monday, May 6th, and according to the Payette Enterprise on May 9th, they were on the verge of nervous prostration. They stayed with the Hallett family in North Payette.
The people of Payette started a fund for Charlotte and Marjorie, and after Charlotte's account of the disaster was published in the Statesman on June 2nd, money started coming in from all over the state. The editor of the Statesman implored readers to send a $3 check made out to Mrs. Collier. The Boise Stylists Company, which produced popular music, pledged the proceeds of their song Titanic Heroes, and a polo game benefiting the Colliers was also talked about, but it's not stated that it was actually played. Polo was pretty popular in Boise at the time.
So I actually have ordered a copy of the sheet music for Titanic Heroes from the Library of Congress. I was hoping it would get here before we recorded the episode and that we could have it somehow made into a recording of that song to play with this episode. But fortunately, I don't think it'll be here before this releases, so we'll maybe release that on YouTube or something once we get that put together.
Fine idea, Jeff. Dandy.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought so. Kind of interesting to have a song about the Titanic produced in Boise, so I figured, you know, we're the type of guys that would make that known to the public once again, right?
I think we should.
By August 2nd, Charlotte and Marjorie had received $2,128 from the public, and that's over $66,000 in today's money. That would probably have started them with a nice life in Payette, but by then the mother and daughter were already on their way back to England. Charlotte had wanted to make the fruit farm in Payette work because it was Harvey's dream, but the reality was harsh. The land Harvey had been in negotiations to buy had been cleared, but that was it. Trees would have had to be purchased, a watering system put in, and there wasn't even a house on the property for them to live in. It would have been difficult to make work had Harvey still had been with them, but for a tuberculosis-afflicted widow and single mother, it probably seemed impossible.
Wow, so she missed out on that $2,128?
No, I think the money was forwarded back to them back in England. But yeah, they didn't stay in Idaho.
Okay, well, yeah, I don't blame her. That's hard work. You know, they might have been better off staying in Idaho. In 1914, Charlotte remarried a licensed victualler? Oh, a liquor salesman named James Holm. Just 2 years later, though, Charlotte succumbed to tuberculosis on November 28, 1916. She was 35. James died in 1919, and Marjorie, now 15 years old, went on to live with her uncle. Details are not mentioned, but this was an unhappy living situation. She lived with his family until she married in 1927, but became a widow when her husband died in 1943. She never remarried and supported herself by working as a receptionist in a doctor's office. Dang.
During this time, Marjorie corresponded with Walter Lord for his book, A Night to Remember, which chronicles the sinking of the Titanic. Mark, have you ever read any Walter Lord books? He was quite prolific.
I have not. Not that I could even name one.
Let me tell you a couple of books he's written. You might recognize at least the subject matter. So he wrote The Miracle of Dunkirk, which was the movie Dunkirk obviously was based on.
Oh, cool.
Day of Infamy, about the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Incredible Victory, the Battle of Midway, Time to Stand, oh, yeah. The Epic of the Alamo. So yeah, he wrote a lot of books.
Yeah, the one about the Day of Infamy, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. So his book on about the Titanic was turned into a movie in 1958. Again, that was called A Night to Remember. You can find that on YouTube. You can find both the regular version, the black and white version, for free, or you can buy the colorized version for a couple bucks. But in that movie, A Night to Remember, it depicts the scene during the loading of the lifeboats when Charlotte is telling her husband that she doesn't want him to leave. Harvey replies to her, "Please, Lottie, for God's sake, be brave and go. I'll get a place in another boat. Lottie, please." And it's pretty close to what he said in real life. And again, you can and should watch that on YouTube.
For free, huh?
Yes, sir.
In her later years, Marjorie suffered from poor health and was placed in a nursing home. She died at the age of 61 after suffering a stroke in 1965. Marjorie had made some comments later in her life about how she felt she could have died on the Titanic, since she was never happy after the tragedy. And that is the story of the would-be Idahoans that set sail on the RMS Titanic in April of 1912.
All right. What do you think, Mark?
I sure feel bad for Marjorie. Dang. Well, and her mom, Charlotte. That is, you look in the picture that you've shown me, and they just look totally haunted. And you think that had to have happened to, you know, in some shape or form, to other people, you know, well, PTSD that we know now, they must have had loved ones lost. Many of them, most of them men who, you know, in those days were the sole breadwinners in many of those families and most of those. Yeah, you just think the ramifications just rippled through the, you know, decades for these people in their lives.
I guess the closest event that we have in our lives was probably September 11th, right? Where you have this mass casualty event where it's just lots of people dying all at once. And yeah, you see the pictures from that and some of the survivor stories. It sounds a lot like what Charlotte and Marjorie went through.
I just think of the fear that would grip me if I was floating in the water, you know? And in the movie, it depicts, you know, being on the ship as it's going under. I have sort of a strange fascination with pictures or paintings of famous sinkings, you know, and how that must have been. You know, there's a frightening one of in the Great Lakes, the Edmund Fitzgerald, right?
Yeah.
How that would have looked. And obviously the Lusitania under different circumstances, being torpedoed, but just how frightening that would be to, you know, have this void below you and, you know, just really how unsure anything really is, no matter how many people say. And I've heard that the 1200 lifeboats, lifeboats for 1200 people, was done because they were so sure that it wouldn't sink because of those watertight holds and how big it was. So I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it was because they didn't really worry about all the passengers, but I think it was more that they didn't think they would have to.
There's a lot that goes into that. So I actually had five facts that we're going to go over, and this was number five, but we'll talk about this more now since you brought it up. Yeah, so that... It was true that there was not enough lifeboats for nearly half the people aboard. In the 1997 movie, Rose is actually talking to Thomas Andrews, the ship's chief designer. And yeah, they talk about that. And then later on during the sinking, he reminds her, like, you remember what we talked about? And he says, go get to a boat now. So it kind of builds the drama for the movie. But yeah, the thing about that, though, is they were actually had more lifeboat capacity than that they were required by law at the time.
Oh, okay.
And then, yeah, the thought about it is it was safer to stay with the boat, with the ship, instead of getting into a small little dinghy out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Think about, you know, everything that could go wrong if you were to get into a lifeboat and you didn't really need to.
I watched this great documentary. It was fairly recent, and it basically showed that it took really long to lower those boats from the top decks, right, all the way down to the water. You know, they didn't have the crew, apparently. They were all locked below, but they didn't have enough crew to lower those in time to have saved, you know, most of the people on the boat anyhow, with how quick the boat was sinking.
Yeah, exactly. Like I mentioned before, there were actually two collapsible lifeboats. And in the movie, they show this where at the last moment, they're running up to try to get that last lifeboat off and try to get it into the water. And then the other collapsible B flipped over while they were trying to, because it was like they were stowed on the top of one of the cabin areas. And so as they were trying to get it off there, it flipped over. And actually some, I think about 20 men were able to crawl on top of it and survive that way. Actually, Charles Lightoller, who was the second or third officer aboard the Titanic, actually survived. He was the one that did go into the water and was able to climb up onto this overturned collapsible boat. But yeah, like you mentioned, Mark, like they did not have enough time during the sinking to even get the boats that they had out. So if they had more, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. Long story short, right?
Well, yeah, in this documentary, I think James Cameron was on it, but they did more tests. They had more technology.
Yeah, that's the same one where they did the with the Jack and Rose on the door part. Yeah, so that's the same one.
Yeah, and they had all the lifeboat, like a pretty much to the T, a lifeboat set up that they could try and lower. It was really interesting to watch.
I think it took them around half an hour.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think it took them around half an hour to actually prepare it and lower it. So, yeah, it's a long time. And you only had 2 to 3 hours to do 20 lifeboats. So each one's taking about a half an hour. It's a miracle that as many people survived as they did. So let's go through these five facts. And I got to substitute one because we just talked about one of them. Let's talk about a guy named Phillips. He was the wireless operator for the Titanic. The day before the Titanic sank, the wireless set had actually broken, and against company policy, he went in and he fixed that wireless set. And if he had not had done that, everyone aboard the Titanic probably would have ended up freezing to death aboard the lifeboat. So there probably would have been no survivors had he not violated company policy and fixed that wireless set. So that's pretty interesting.
I wonder why that was company policy. That's kind of crazy.
It was brand new technology at the time, so probably only certified people could work on that piece of equipment.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, yeah, good thing he did, man.
Yeah, and like I mentioned, it wasn't for safety at the time. It was for getting messages to the mainland. So one of my other five interesting facts, in 1943, a Titanic film was made in Nazi Germany. You ever heard about this one, Mark?
No, I haven't. That's new.
So, yeah, this is interesting. And actually, it's interesting. In that film, like, there's this whole subplot where the owners of the White Star Line are trying to buy more stock from the White Star Line. And anyway, they're using the wireless on board the ship to buy and sell those stocks. So that's kind of why I jumped to this one. This is my third one. But anyway, it was supposed to be a propaganda film, and it featured a fictional German officer who tried to slow the ship down and save it from the British arrogance that caused the sinking. However, by the time the movie was ready for release, it was banned by Joseph Goebbels because Allied bombing campaigns were starting to target civilian areas of Germany, and they didn't want to show the people basically mass casualty events, you know, in the theaters. Right. Also by this time, the Third Reich itself was basically a sinking ship.
Right. You know, and I love that, you know, yeah, I could see the whole British Empire arrogance thing. But, you know, if there were anybody as arrogant as the British during that time period, it would have been the Germans. You know what I mean? It's, like, come on. Anyway, the Prussians, the, you know, right, the Bavarians.
They still, yeah, Europeans. Anyway.
Yeah, pretty much all, you know, the Russians for sure. Although that's mainly in Asia. But you get my point.
Right. Here's another fun Titanic fact for you. Thomas Andrews, who was he was the chief designer of the ship, and he was a victim. He died in the sinking, very famously in the 1997 movie and in A Night to Remember. He's last seen kind of in the ballroom, I believe it is, or one of the state rooms. And he's standing in front of the fireplace, just basically waiting for the ship to sink. But he was only 39 years old, Mark. Man designed the world's most famous ship, and he was only 39 years old. Kind of makes me sad of what I've accomplished in my life.
Right. You know, hey, different times. You know, I don't know if that's true. You know.
I guess he was about middle-aged by then, right?
Yeah, but on the plus side, you haven't died in a, you know, ship sinking into the freezing water, like what, how deep below you, like 1300 feet or something? No, more than that, right?
2.5 miles.
Oh yeah, that's a waste. Yeah. Wow. Jeez.
Well, I have 3 years, so let's not curse it.
Right. Yeah. You're lucky. I've already passed that threshold, but,
that's all right.
Wow.
Another Titanic fact for you. Adjusted for inflation, it cost more to make the 1997 James Cameron Titanic movie than it actually took to build the Titanic by about $10 million.
I remember that about that movie. You know, it was like with his new Avatar movies. It's like, what happened to James Cameron? He's just been making this movie forever, or trying to make it. It's just like then with Avatar 2, you know, it's like, wow, it's been quite some time that he has been making. That just seems to be what he does. But, you know, I have to say, I finally admit it. I'm man enough to admit it. I really do like that movie. You know, it's quite an epic. I don't.
Avatar or Titanic?
Well, both, actually. But yeah, Titanic.
Yeah, it's a good one. Like, just the incredible amount of work that went into that film is just crazy.
My favorite Cameron movies were always going to be The Terminator, Aliens, and T2, obviously. I saw T2 in the theater with my dad, and I enjoyed every freaking moment of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I love that whole franchise.
Yeah, great.
What else do I got here? Just for – got that one. All right, so here I think
– PCP? Five.
Yeah. So have you heard this one?
No, I just saw something about PCP here in front of me.
So, yeah, during the filming of the 1997 Titanic movie, a still unknown person put PCP, the drug, into some chowder that was being served to the cast and crew. They ended up in the hospital doing conga lines and acting like they were on drugs, of course, because they were.
Right.
And James Cameron and Bill Paxton were among those affected by that.
Bill Paxton was in Titanic?
Yeah. So he's in the remember at the beginning, they're in the modern day and they're showing him going down in the submersible to find the safe because they're looking for the diamond.
That's one of right.
The crew members that were aboard that ship. Yeah.
Rest in peace, Bill Paxton. I like that dude.
Yeah. He's in some good movies. Twister. Come on. Till I get better than that.
Oh, right. Twister is great. A classic. They're remaking it or something. They're making a new one, I heard. But who knows with the strike in Hollywood.
Right. Oh, yeah. He was in Tombstone as well, right?
Yeah, he didn't have a very glorious part in that. He kind of played like a dirtbag. But, you know, hey, a movie in a – or a place in a movie like that is pretty great.
Definitely. I'm going to add one here, Mark. I know I've done like – this is like 7 of my 5 interesting Titanic facts.
Cool.
So not only has James Cameron spent more time with the Titanic than Captain Smith had, the ship's captain.
Wow.
He was actually down in a submersible visiting the Titanic when the news of the attacks on the World Trade Center on 9/11 happened. And if you watch the movie called Ghosts of the Abyss, there's actually a scene where he comes up and they let him out of the submersible and then they give him the news of the attacks that had happened hours before, and you see him react to it, and it's kind of interesting that he was, you know, at the bottom of the ocean while, you know, all this was unfolding in our nation that day.
Yeah, there's these pinnacle moments in a nation where it kind of changes the trajectory of history, you know. I mean, thinking through some of these, and it sometimes it's just, you know, a president being killed, you know, JFK. Or I'm reading this book on Custer's Last Stand, and that totally changed the viewpoint of history. It was all, for Americans, it was all positive and like, oh, we're going the right direction after the Civil War, and that hit, and it was like a bomb going off. Like, oh, we're vulnerable still, you know, and then, of course, the Titanic. But to come up and realize that, you know, in the Titanic, we weren't attacked, right? You know, Lusitania has always fascinated me because of, you know, was the Lusitania running arms and materials for the war, the Allies, you know, but still it's like you kill all these innocent people that are on there still. And I think because it happened, relatively soon after the Titanic, what, in like 1916 or something like that, the Lusitania gets kind of not paid attention to as much. But it was harsh too.
What launched us into the First World War was the sinking of the Lusitania. So that, like you said, it's definitely one of those defining moments in history.
Well, there's just these amazing moments in history that just change the trajectory of whole generations of people. And the Titanic, I think, was definitely one of them. But I was another thing I'm sure you know about is, you know, people are like, well, where are the Titanic dead? And, you know, when they go down there, and it's like, it's just their shoes, you know, because they've been eroded by the ocean and animals and silt or whatever, but it's just their shoes. So when you see these pairs of shoes, you know, that's where a soul was, you know, departed soul was, but it's kind of creepy when you think about that.
Yeah, if you watch some of those videos of the submersibles going through there, it's, you know, a lot of rust, it's a lot of debris, but every once in a while you'll see, like, you know, talking about Marjorie and her doll, you'll see like a porcelain doll face, or, you know, like shed the shoes, and really puts that humanity back into the story that sometimes we lack when we're talking about some of these stories.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's why it's important to have those quotes and that those personal stories. But, you know, I mean, you can't really dive through the Titanic at all, you know, so the best you're going to get is submersibles, right? And then I guess they have cameras attached to them. But speaking of that, I didn't know, were you going to talk about the recent disaster? Or?
We can. I wasn't really going to go over it, but yeah, we could talk about it.
I was just going to say, you know, briefly, I guess I was thinking like some fancy submersible that, you know, like the one you see with James Cameron, like a really high tech looking machine. But then I saw that they like close these people in with bolts.
Yeah.
And then the guy basically has has what looks like a PlayStation, you know, handheld controller.
Right.
And I just was like, that's what they're controlling this thing with, you know? Oh, wow. I was like, if I had the chance to see the Titanic, I don't know if I would, because that sounds about like one of the worst endings you could ever imagine.
There are various simulations, computer simulations that are just fine to do that with. There's no need to go down there, I don't think. But, you know, I think what they should do is set up some cameras or something down there to watch how it degrades over the next, you know, 10, 20, 50 years. Because they say within about 50 to 80 years, there's going to be pretty much nothing recognizable left of the wreck. So we definitely need to document it. But I don't think sending humans down there is important, especially with the technology.
Well, plus, it's a tomb.
Yeah,
it's a tomb. You know, you don't see, I know that, like, you know, in the Edmund Fitzgerald, they've ruled off diving there unless you're like a researcher or, you know, you need to go down there for a specific person or reason. Like, you can't go down there because it's being treated like a tomb. You know, you obviously, for many reasons, you can't go down with the USS Arizona, which is much closer. But, or any of those, I believe, you know, because they're a tomb. And I don't think this is the place to have, no matter how rich these people are, I don't think it's the place to have a whole bunch of the public going down there, or not a whole bunch, but you get my point, going down there and seeing this place. You know, I don't think it's respectable, but it's just me.
You know, I've seen that argument quite a bit that, yeah, it's a graveyard. It's, you know, a monument to these people. But, you know, we go to graveyards on land all the time. We used to have picnics and, you know, play games and stuff in graveyards. Not so much anymore, but, you know.
Yeah, but we don't crack them open and go inside, you know, with the people, you know. You know.
That's true. There's also the issue. Some of these submersibles have actually set down on the deck of the Titanic, which has caused further degradation to the wreck. So that's an obviously big issue as well.
Yeah, I don't know. In the end, those people were curious. I can understand that. Right. You know, in the, you know, as much as the world joked about them or said, oh, they were rich and they just got too, you know, into themselves or I don't know, egotistical and wanted to say they did this, you know, I don't know. It's too bad that they did. Before I heard about this, I don't know what I would have done, but right. You know, I have to imagine there would be a part of me freaking out as I got in that thing and they bolted it shut. But you know, now I know what I know now. But geez, anyway, but it's the same thing for people who climb Everest, you know?
Yeah.
But again, you're not in a tube of, you know, tomb kind of thing already, you know, it's just freaky to me.
I've been thinking about the implications that this incident has had for the coming space tourism, that we're sure to see some disasters come from that in the next, probably within our lifetime, I'm assuming.
I would imagine. But I'm not super rich, so I never have to worry about it, right?
That's true. We're right. Just a couple poor boys. Nobody yeah. loves us.
Well, the people who love me, they're not rich either. Right. Anyway, well, this was a good one, Jeff.
Thank you. Yeah, I figured it'd be interesting to see connections between the Titanic and because obviously this is a story that kind of like I remember reading that Dr. Robert Ballard book when I was a kid. And I think a lot of people probably in between you and my age read that book. So I think, you know, ever since we were kids, we've known about the Titanic and the disaster and been curious about it. So,
right. I mean, I can obviously remember seeing pictures of the bow. Right. Yeah. You know, just next week, you know, I'm going in another direction about, you know, as this group of people was famous as far as the Idahoans or future Idahoans they were trying to be that died on the Titanic or because of the Titanic. Basically, I wanted to look at Wyatt Earp and his time in Idaho. And the reason it became interesting to me is because he wasn't quite the hero in Eagle City, Idaho territory as he was in Tombstone, Arizona. You know, and so it's interesting how, you know, he was definitely a hero by then and even before he went to Tombstone. But it's just interesting that he was looked upon a little differently after he left Idaho. But nobody knows about it, right? Because yeah. He was always already so well known for whatever. But that's what I'm going to be looking into. I thought we'd get into some, you know, Old West lore and one of the most famous characters, if not the most, other than Wild Bill. Jesse James and Billy the Kid, right? So anyway, that's what we're looking at.
I will shine up my six shooter and get ready for that. I'm interested
in yeah. that. You know, of course, I want to be like Doc Holliday, but he didn't come up this way, obviously. So,
all right. I think with that, we'll go ahead and sign off and say see you next week.
Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. Visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. If you like what we're doing, please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart.